Welcome. You are listening to The Creative Spark. My name is G. Brian Benson, and I'm an award-winning author, project coach, actor, TEDx speaker, creative, and four-time Ironman triathlete. I love to creatively inspire and be inspired. And with each episode, I will be talking of authors, athletes, entrepreneurs, artists, and actors sharing their journey of success and learning how to find the joy and peace of mind that comes with stepping into one's own skin and going beyond anything they might previously have thought possible. I hope that their stories and strategies provide insight, tools, and empowerment to step up your creative game and help you live your best life. So without further ado, let's get going. My next guest is fantastic. Blake Robbins is an award-winning actor, writer, and director. In 2012, after years in front of the camera, in such notable TV shows and movies as Oz, Sons of Anarchy, The Office, and Firefly, he stepped behind it to write, direct, produce, and act in his feature film debut, The Sublime and Beautiful, which world premiered at the 20th Annual Slam Dance Film Festival in 2014 and enjoyed a very successful film festival run, which included many awards and nominations. More recently, Blake directed the well-received and reviewed film, The Scent of Rain and Lightning, and is currently enjoying a successful screenwriting competition run with his latest script, Into the Lake of Fire. Blake also co-authored the book, Acting Cues, Conversations with Working Actors with casting director and author Bonnie Gillespie. Welcome, Blake.
Hey. Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my God. It's my pleasure. You're multifaceted, multi-talented, and this is perfect for this show. And I look forward to diving into all the disciplines, and we have a lot to cover. So I thought we'd just kind of go chronologically. So let's start with acting.
From birth?
Yes.
I know. Not that far back?
Not quite that far back.
Okay.
When you were just a glint in your father's eye.
Maybe I was a glint. Maybe I was a 32 ounce Budweiser. I don't know.
Oh my gosh. This is going to be good. This is amazing to me. You've had a lot of ups and downs during your career, as I know all actors have, and
yep,
screenwriters, et cetera. Yep. I read where you didn't get paid for nearly 6 years after you got out of acting school. Your first gig, you didn't get paid for 6 years.
That might have been conservative estimate too. So I go to New York City to break into acting, and I go to acting school. So I go to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and I auditioned regionally up in Boston. I was in Boston. I had gotten out of college and was just kind of floating, trying to figure out what to do with my life. Had a degree in business marketing. Had put some time in with my dad's company. Was bartending for a while, and started doing plays in Boston and taking a few small acting classes. Mm-hmm. And had in my mind gotten to the idea of, I'm going to take a leap. I'm going to do it. I'm going to audition for this acting school, and I don't know how I'm going to get there, but if they'll take me, I'll figure a way, and I'll go to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Well, they saw something in me and invited me into their fall class of 1992. Mm. So I went. I figured it out. And honestly,
was it scary?
It was terrifying. I had nothing. I didn't have a place to stay. I didn't have money to go there. Mm. In fact, at one point, I truly didn't see the path forward and called them and told them I couldn't come, that I needed time, and would they hold my opening for a year so I could try and put things in order? Mm-hmm. And they said, sure, but let them know if there was anything they could do on their end. They were very, polite about it. And I couldn't sleep. I could not sleep that night after I called them and told them I couldn't come. I was tortured. I was like, how can I not take, I can't imagine the next year of not doing this somehow. Yeah. So I literally got on the phone the next day and I said, scratch that, forget that. I don't know what I was thinking. I will figure it out. But I just purged. I told the admissions office, the woman, Jeannie Goslin, who ended up being a wonderful friend and huge influence and help in my life. Mm. And I told her my situation financially, this, and she started helping. She said, okay, when you get here, you can work in my office. I always need one or two students mornings and afternoons. If you're in the afternoon school, you can work the morning. If you're in the morning program, you can work the afternoon. I ended up being in the afternoon program and work mornings there. So I had a job. Boom. Okay. Nice. So, and she just started helping me knock down dominoes. Now everything didn't go beautifully, but I felt like I was walking on air. I think it's maybe what you feel like the moment you jump out of an airplane for the first time, and you know that there are things in place to save you, but you know, things go wrong. You can't be 100% sure.
Sure.
And so that's kind of what it was. It was one of those life moments, and it wasn't a smooth ride after that. It was bumpy, but I never once had a sleepless night like the night I had when I said, I can't see how I can do this. And I figured it out. And I learned some important lessons. You just tell people. You tell people your truth. You tell people what you need. You tell people what you're struggling with. You ask for help.
And people want to help.
And these were things I did not do easily. And still after that, did not do easily. I figured, like, I don't know. I think I lived much of my life not thinking that I deserved help. But that's a long story for another time. But I just, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, I had that feeling like that I had to do it on my own, but they will help. And they did in immense ways that I couldn't have done it without them, school and some friends I made along the way. So now I'm in New York and I'm acting every day. And I do that for a couple of years and I get out. And I had success in acting school at the American Academy. They're wonderfully open to passion. And so it's not the hardest school to get into if you demonstrate some real desire to be there. Mm-hmm. But they do have a huge attrition rate. Like to get into from first year to second year, it's like less than 50% get invited to second year. Mm. So you have to show them something in that first year. And they get lost, you know, with like American Idol and every other thing with attrition. Someone always proves them wrong, doesn't get into second year and goes off and becomes the big star. Yeah. There are a bunch of them. And that happens with them, but there is a huge attrition rate. And I ended up making it to the third year company, which was 20 of us. So I started with over 160 students and now I'm in the final 20. And in those five or six plays that we did and performances we put on for the quote unquote industry to come, you know, see our work and see our growth and find out about, you know, the 20 of us as a company. I had three leads out of the five shows. So,
wow.
You know, what I'm sharing is that in that community, I kind of risen to the top. I was kind of like, you know, one of the top echelon of that class. So for me, to come out and go, and you said 6 years, and I have to do math, and I'm not very good at it, but it might have been closer to eight years. It definitely was at least 6 years. I got out of acting school where I spent $40,000 to $50,000 to be there. So I'm coming out of school with some serious debt, you know.
Yeah, but you're also feeling like, you know, I succeeded at this and you're probably ready to succeed in the other.
Yeah.
And the other wasn't happening for a long time.
No, yeah, it was a shock. It was a blow. It was a blow to my ego.
That the
industry did not give a crap that Blake Robbins had done well at acting school. They pretty much showed me their true colors. They weren't going to care one iota about me and my little dreams and hopes.
Yeah.
So, and I had gone to acting school a little later, so I didn't show up there at 20 years old. You know, I had gone to college and gotten out of college and done some things in Boston before. So the time is feels like it's, you know, running away from me a little bit in this
sure.
career where you think that if you don't hit early, you may never hit at all. I definitely am walking evidence that you can hit in your 30s. a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
And want to encourage people out there that if you know something in your soul and that feels undeniable to you, just persevere, find hope, figure it out.
But
trust that what's going on in your heart. I had to trust it when there was nothing around supporting that I had any right to.
Yeah.
There was no evidence the only evidence was internal. There was no external evidence that I had done the right thing and was doing the right thing with my life. My friends were all succeeding at life. They were all going on to, you know, have wonderful careers and business and law and accounting.
Sure.
And I'm a bellman, you know, in a hotel in New York, you know, approaching my 30s and $50,000 in debt and not an acting job to scene, no agent, no manager. I'll tell you how bad it got. We did a scene night at school where we put on, you know, where we did our monologues and some scenes. And mm-hmm. I'm going to say, you know, the school does attract people to that. And there were over 100 different agents and managers from the community.
My. Wow.
And in a very Hunger Games type format, the next day they put up sheets of paper with your name and under your name, all the agents and managers who wish for you to contact them.
Yeah.
And they post this in the lobby of the school for everyone to see.
That's not cool.
All the first years, all the seconds. It's just, I think it's just, for them, it was just efficiency. They weren't thinking about what...
They weren't crushing it could be.
They weren't thinking about Blake Robbins going through his list and seeing no names. And the other 19 actors, I don't know that there was anyone else that had no names. So for anyone who was hating on me for having those three leads in those plays, this was their opportunity to get their revenge. Oh, Blake, how's it going? How's your day today, Blake?
Punch.
Nobody wanted to see Blake, so that's how I got out of acting school, and so I had to want it against what seemed like insurmountable odds. But I learned something in my head: things are improbable, there nothing's impossible.
Yes,
that's just kind of become a motto of my life. Yes. That I've carried ever since. I refuse to believe that anything is impossible, but improbable, sure. And my career at that moment seemed very improbable.
Yeah.
that many agents and managers and casting directors from New York City came and no one wanted to talk to me after.
Jeez. So,
and I wasn't horrible, I don't think. off the stage that night thinking I had bombed. It just was a message from the universe that, you're going to have to climb Mount Everest here. So get busy.
Wow. So how long did you stay in New York the whole time during this period? Or did you move to LA before? Okay. So you got your role on Oz when you were in New York?
Yeah. Yeah. And
tell me about that.
That came those years later. I didn't have an agent or manager. Mm-hmm. I was doing playing a small part in a really cool play with some really cool people that I had workshopped for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it was a play with live basketball.
Oh,
yeah. And I played a basketball player in the play and had a few funny moments and stuff, but it was fun and it was a cool play and a lot of talented people involved. And we got to run around with some of the coolest theater companies in New York, the Naked Angels. I remember when Ben Affleck came to see it Ferris Bueller.
Broderick.
Matthew Broderick came to see us. Howard Stern came to see it when we were at the, you know, we ended up playing one summer at the Atlantic Theater Company, which, you know, is David Mamet. It's in a beautiful church on the East 20th. Anyway, bad with names, even though I'm dropping them like basketballs right now. But I remember the famous ones. But anyway.
Yeah.
David Mamet and the gentleman from Shameless. It's their theater company. Macy, William H. Macy. The Atlantic is their theater company. We were sort of, because the people in the play were connected to a lot of people. We were sort of a guest artist show that summer at their theater. And that's where a lot of people started coming. Well, a few weeks in there, somewhere around there, Oz was casting for a basketball player. And the casting director for Oz came to see our show. Mm. And it kind of rumor spread that people knew that they were looking for a basketball player to be in this new role in Oz. I didn't have HBO. I was broke. I had never seen Oz. I didn't really know anything about it, except people were very excited. And Alexa Fogel, huge casting director then and now in New York, came to see our show. And she asked my buddy Randy Ryan to come and audition. He was in the show with me playing another basketball player. And God bless Randy Ryan. He handled it so gracefully. He didn't brag, or, you know, he didn't make anyone who didn't get invited feel horrible. He was such, sure. he is such a good human being. But I did know about it. Randy was my best friend in the show. And we did occasionally discuss. And he was like, Blake, you got to get in. You got to get in. He was rooting for me. And I was like, she came and saw the show and invited you. I didn't get an invitation to the party. She saw me. How do I surmount that? Well, on this particular day, we were doing two shows. It was a weekend. We did two shows on Saturdays and Sundays. So we had had lunch, and I had gotten very depressed during lunch with not having an agent. And at that time, Randy not only had that call, he had a bunch of things. He had a few managers come and want to meet with him because of the show. So I just felt, and here it is, comparison is the thief of joy. But in our industry, how do you not?
Oh my God. Yeah. No, I, yeah.
Two guys. I mean, we're human beings. True. How do we not look to the left and look to the right and say, wow, look what's happening for Randy with this show. I got none of that. And so I was kind of really devastated that day. And I went back to the theater, and it's a beautiful theater. And I sat in the audience in the dark, just waiting for the second show, and morose. Mm. And one of our producers, lovely woman, Beth approached me and said, Blake, are you okay? I said, No. And I explained to her, I said, Alexa Fogel, Oz, blah, 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 basketball player. I said, what do I do? And she said, well, you know, their offices is like walking distance from here. And I said, oh, beautiful, wonderful. She said, it's like six blocks that way. They were in a beautiful, that's where Oz shot, and their offices were on the floor above it. And
oh, wow.
Down below, they had all these restaurants. It was where, you know, if anyone from New York is there, it was the building that the news show NY1 always was in, and the first floor, it's all these wonderful bakeries and restaurants and things. Beautiful building on the Lower East Side. So about six blocks from the theater. Mm. And Beth starts giving me some advice about how I could drop off a headshot and resume and what I could maybe put in that letter. And then she took a little pause. And the artist in me remembers little details like this. Mm-hmm. And she said, wait a second. I know the assistant at that office very well because of my years working as an agent. An assistant and agent I called over. In fact, we represented Harold Pruneau, who got on the show, when he got on the show. So I had many conversations with that office. She said, I can call Mercedes and see if we get you seen. Mm. That's what she said. Mm. I was like, oh, that would be amazing. The next day I came to do the show, and she said, Mercedes says you can come in on Thursday. Here's the sides. I was like, okay. So now I have the scenes, and I know I'm going in, and I'm being put on tape for the assistant. And I did. I went from the theater. I grabbed a basketball, carried it with me. I went in my sweats, and I went over there, and the scenes felt very comfortable on me. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of a Midwestern basketball player, kind of an aw shucks guy. And I'd been doing this for a while, and there was no stakes. I had no agent manager, no one invested, at least in, I didn't know the show. So I went in, I met this lovely assistant, Mercedes, who then became a friend afterwards. And I do remember in the hallway waiting to go in that most of the people waiting to go in, there was about five or six of us waiting outside. They had a definite edge to them.
Meaning what?
Meaning, you know, I don't want to summarize people that way. It's hard, but they looked very tough.
Confident.
They looked tough. They looked inner city. They looked like guys you would find in the cages, which I would go play in the cages in New York occasionally because I was a pretty good basketball player. And when I showed up, I definitely didn't look the part, and I was pretty good, and I could shoot, and it would end up in some people knocking me down. Some, you know, it got tough. Because people don't like to be showed up by the white guy from the Midwest who has a little bit of a Larry Bird, you know, but not afraid to talk a little smack. That was me. And they looked like they had, you know, paid their dues and you know, had that vibe. It had the vibe of Oz. Do you know what I mean? If you do watch the show, people familiar with the show will know what I mean. There's definitely a tension, an edge. You know, these people look scary. Mm-hmm. You think if you work on the show, you could be gang raped by the cast of characters that you see. And they're all the most lovely, beautiful, wonderful people.
Yeah.
But they don't look it. They look the part. And a lot of them were the part. And oh, Tom Fontana, tremendous. You know, he put a lot of people on the show that had served time, that had to reform their life, had to, you know, make strides and change their ways. So, so that's all I'm saying is I didn't look the part.
Did you feel unconfident then once you realized that?
No. It was what it was. There was just in my mind, no stakes. I had already won because I had gotten this audition that seemed like the last thing I would get.
Yeah.
So I was just grateful and I was there and I did have this streak of fuck it, man. This is mine.
Yep.
And when I slated, I said something so cocky that I'm about to share it with you.
Yeah.
Right now. I said straight into camera, I said, "Hey, my name is Blake Robbins. You might find a better actor to play this role, but you will not find a better basketball player." And I said it just like that. Come to find out later that they were offering the role to professional basketball players who couldn't do it because of scheduling. Wow. I didn't know that Jason Williams, who was, you know, like vanilla.
Oh, ice, yeah. White chocolate.
You know, white chocolate was up for the role, but couldn't do it because of scheduling. So it turned out I was not the best basketball player they could get for the role. but I said it like I was. I believed it when I said it. And I also wanted them to know that I felt that. And I read the scene, and then Mercedes was very good, kind, and she said, "Okay," and she gave me an adjustment. She said, "Do you know our show?" I said, "Nope."
Say that again. You know, I didn't quite catch that.
Oh, she said, "Do you know our show?" and I said, "No." I said, "I don't have money for HBO." So at that time, a lot of people didn't have HBO. It was kind of. And you did have to pay. So it was a new thing, paying subscription for. So it wasn't that embarrassing that I didn't have it.
It's like normally the death now. I mean, normally that's a no-no.
Yeah. And it was probably a little bit of a no-no. But yes, it was okay. She said, you know, it wasn't a huge hiccup the way it would be today. Like, oh, you've got to know something about what you're auditioning for. So she said, "Well, our show's. It's got some tension. It's got some edge." You know, she started describing the show and she was absolutely right. And she said, "So maybe we could do the scene again and you could bring a little more of that. I will honestly say that all I kind of did with the next read was tighten up the cues a little bit because I was still the overly confident, nothing to lose, white guy from the Midwest who didn't know the show and just did the scene again. I will share that it fit me like a glove. But, you know, he was a junior college basketball player. He had gotten in trouble, blah, blah, blah. I just kind of said the lines. She thanked me politely and off I went. At that time, you got phone calls from casting, and I didn't have an agent or manager. I would say before I got home to my apartment, I had a call saying that they wanted to see me in a couple of days and come dressed to play basketball.
Damn.
What I would learn later in life, a few weeks, months later, when I was making the show, Tom Fontana saw the tape and liked me. And he liked the juxtaposition of my energy in the show, that I wasn't like
everybody else.
Yeah, he didn't want to bring in more of what he already had on the show. He liked the contrast, that I was confident and felt right, but that I wasn't another gangbanger, do you know what I mean, or whatever.
Well, can I say something? Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me say something really quick. That is an incredible lesson for actors, because most of the time we try to fit in with everybody else when we go in for an audition, but then you just get lost in the shuffle, right? I mean, you got to be yourself, and you got to come right? I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't overthink it. You can't overknow it. I think all you can go, I would say the core thread in all of his casting and in that show, and that I took forward with me ever since, authenticity was the winner.
That's
authenticity
awesome.
Was what he responded to, and what his talent, as you know, he's given a lot of people a lot of careers. And people don't know this, from his days in St. Elsewhere and coming through the Bruce Stern TV world, and it's a thread you see in all of those guys and all the limbs of that branch. It goes back to that show. You can trace a lot of our current television content back to the show St. Elsewhere, and a lot of them had theater pedigree, and most of them were writers who became television writers, and most of them, they changed the industry, and that they created it as a, you know, where film is a director's medium. You'll notice that almost all of the successful television moving forward became the writer producer, and you'll see it in all those shows. They become the force of that creativity, and made the writer producer the most powerful thing in television, that if you had that talent, and most of them, I would say, respond to authenticity. And so all I had really going for me was authenticity. And so it was because I didn't try to put on something to fit the show that I became something that Tom, now here's something I've since learned. Only 2 or 3% of the entire industry is who Tom Fontana is, which is someone who recognizes what they want and is in a position to say yes to it. The other 97% are literally chasing everyone else's opinion and have no idea what they like.
And are only trying to
escape failure. That's all they're doing, is trying to dodge losing their Hollywood Hills home. So you've got to know that as a human being, as an actor, that you've got to navigate a reality where most of the people in the industry have no fucking clue what's good, bad. They're literally chasing everyone else's opinion. And so it was a lightning strike for me to be authentic and to have a person who responds to that, see it, know it, and have the power to say, yeah, that guy.
That's awesome.
And then bring me into the fold and respond to me and like me, because originally it was only supposed to be a few episodes, but we just clicked when we met each other, and he was a great guy. And apparently he saw something in me, which he had done many times. And so my 2-3 episode arc ended up being till the end of the run of the show. And I had 16 episodes, and I had someone's validation in the industry that I found out later a lot of people inside the industry responded to. Because I sat down with the vice president of casting at CBS when I moved out to LA, and he said, I'm only meeting you because Tom Fontana hired you. He goes, he knows talent. He goes, I can list the number of actors that he is. So here I am with Peter Golden, and he's basically telling me, tell your agent if they see anything on our schedule that they'd like for you to call me directly, and I'll see if I can get you in. Well, he said that politely like that, but he could put me into any. He was the senior vice president of casting. That was his job. So I got added to the list for a while whenever whenever my manager or agent thought that I was right for something. You know, it was mostly for guest star, recurring, this and that.
Sure.
But that just kind of shows you the influence of one person can have in your life. But you got to, I mean, lightning does have to strike, and you have to believe in all those things like luck and perseverance and And there was a lot of reasons for me not to still be in the game by then. And a lot of things could have happened, but
well, right.
It's changed my life.
Absolutely. And you know, you to take advantage of that lightning striking, you had to be prepared, and you were prepared.
Yeah. Yeah. I never didn't stop doing theater and taking classes and working on it and working on myself and growing as a person to the point where I would ask for help or where I would be.
Yeah.
Honest with people about what was going on and what I needed, things that didn't come naturally for me. So there, that was the game changer as an actor. And because I know you mentioned wanting to segue into writing and directing, the beautiful thing about Oz was the freedom that I experienced that I didn't know because I had no other experience to compare it to, where I just watched I watched how they baked the cake every day.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
I went to Video Village. I was polite about it and everything, but I didn't sit in my room. I watched them make the shows. Every time I was on set, I was observing. And during that same time, I offered to help Rob Morrow make his self-directed, written, and acted, produced film, which later became known as Maze. And I spent 2 months just driving him to set and being around set and helping wherever I could. And that experience of lending myself to someone else, like to say, I simply for the experience and the growth of me, I will give you everything I have for 2 months to try and do this. And so the combination of those two experiences in the year 2000, I think about maybe give or take a few months here or there, but it was right before 9/11 in 2000, and I had them, and that became the beginning of my film school of observation, because I didn't go to film school, but I watched, and I was a sponge. I watched how they talked to actors. I watched how they lit scenes. I just watched the mechanics of everything. I was interested in all of it. And some actors aren't. Some just want to act and want to be left like racehorses with blinders. They just want to get put in the gate and let go. And honestly, they're usually fantastic actors that way. But then there's other actors like me who I wanted to know a little bit about everything. I wanted to kind of, because I guess in hindsight, there was a storyteller in me. And a few years later, instead of branding myself to myself as an actor, I started branding myself as a storyteller. And that's when things started to change.
Well, did you know way back then when you were observing and being a sponge that you wanted to start writing?
No.
Okay.
No.
When did that happen?
That came after I moved to LA and there were personal circumstances in my life and 9/11 that triggered in me the idea that I had a story to tell. And feeling like, and I resisted it for a long time because what my fears were bigger than my need to tell the story for a while. My fear that I've never written anything. All I have in my history is teacher telling me I sucked at writing. All I had, you know, I didn't have anything to lean on. So again, in retrospect, with a little hindsight, I had to learn that I had to want it enough to overcome obstacles that were already in place, that had been put there at an early age. Like I said, like teachers reading my writing and saying, maybe you'll do something else with your life. Offer me no encouragement whatsoever.
It makes it so much harder. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I hear you.
But the beauty of things being so much harder is you rise to the occasion or you don't. And so, I try to spin it all now as what was the opportunity? Because now I can adjust to that faster. Back then it took years. You know what I mean? Years of growth and understanding to make that connection that I just made right there in a split second. But now if someone tells me you can't have or do this, I go, okay, what's the opportunity? There's you just told me something that takes me to the prompt. Because you said that, whoever you are, whatever you are, like, oh, your movie's not gonna get made because blah, 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 blah. I'm like, okay, there's the answer to how my movie does get made.
Watch
my answer to how it doesn't. Yeah.
Right.
I'm like, okay, you just give me that information and I'll process it and I'll either, but now I'm a little bit of a well-oiled machine of no one determines my story but me. then I was like, oh, all these outside influences
had
significant impact.
Yeah, you feel like you're at the mercy of everybody else. But now, you know, when we're going to start talking about this, but I mean, once you've done all these things and you've created your own stuff and gotten them out there, you have a lot more tools at your disposal. You have a lot more confidence, you have a lot more connections. I mean, it's just you can make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I'm, I've earned it. So I'll say it, I still glitch. Like I was about to glitch to say this because it sounds so cocky, but now I am a powerful tool of creation. Now you can't fucking get in my way. Now I'm an unstoppable force. I may move to the left, or I may need time, or I may have to, I may have to figure out, is this one of those times where I will it, or is this one of those times where I just kind of get zen and just know in my heart, it's happening.
Let it come to you.
So it's coming.
Yeah.
So you can tell me no all you want, but I'm just going to let this happen. Because before, early on, I only had I have to will this into existence. Now I have both. Now I know, I'm going to sit back and allow this to happen.
Yes.
Well, and trust that just as much, that sometimes it doesn't take me bashing down things. And, but a few of in the early days, that was the only way I thought I could do it. How sublime and beautiful came into place.
That's what I talk about that. Yeah. Because you must have gained so much confidence from doing that experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the way every single movie is. You'll never make a movie, for those out there who haven't made a movie. But this is just the truth, and it's become sort of something you hear on sets all the time. You're ready to make a movie on the last day of making a movie. because you have learned, the process has taught you something. So, but that experience never goes away. There will never be a movie you make where you're not feeling that on the last day because of whatever the process was. And that's life. And it goes back to now things in my mind of, where I recognize these things like neuroplasticity and growth mindset and does someone have grit and all these things that are needed for you to achieve and do the things you want to achieve and do. Now they're tools at my disposal. They're in my tool belt, that awareness that, I've got to be willing to learn something here. So, okay, but that's not going to stop me from doing it. And those were things I didn't have when I started out on Sublime. When I started out on Sublime, really all I had was, I was pissed off because the world wasn't letting me be a lead in a movie. And why would they? I mean, there was no reason. But I was angry about it because I felt like I should be the lead in a movie. So what did I have to do to be the lead in the movie? I had to create a lead role and cast myself. Mm-hmm. And now, if any actor within 1,000 miles of me saying this hears this, please know there's two ways to get a job in Hollywood. One is to have someone give it to you, and the other is to give it to yourself.
Yeah.
When you really process that, which sounds more likely to happen? Give yourself a job.
Yeah.
Teach Hollywood what you do best. Teach them. Let them know what you're capable of. If you're not working on that, you are literally operating heavy machinery with one arm.
Yeah.
But you could have two arms. So please, if you can hear me, get good at all of it and learn how, because our industry is littered with people who created their own opportunity.
Oh. Tons of people
have,
they'll put a show on YouTube and it'll just kind of grow and then they'll get picked up. I mean, like, I think Issa Rae and that the woman who did the OA, I mean, they wrote those themselves.
Yes. To sketch comedy groups, the art form is your choice. I would say let your passion and your intuition and your develop those muscles. And work with the people you love. They will be your support staff, your support group going forward. But get busy doing the shit that you want to do, the way you want to do it, because there's energy and synergy in that. And it's never going to get in the way of someone deciding out of thin air, I'm going to give this person a job. But just remember, I just told you 97% of the industry doesn't have any idea how to give you a job. Only 3% do. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying you won't get a job with those other 97%, but it's just dumb luck. It's literally just, okay, let's give it to this guy. I mean,
yeah.
So I mean, you can't count on that, but that is a reality. It does happen. It happens all the time.
Sure.
But don't just be that person.
Well, not only if you're creating your own stuff, you're presenting yourself an opportunity, you're also gaining confidence in an education, yeah, which makes you more confident going into, yeah, those auditions that you have for the other 97%.
Yeah, remember, the other 97% are chasing something they can't identify. But one of those things that they can identify is like Mindy Kaling making the show about, mm-hmm, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck and having everyone talk about it. And then those other 97%, oh, we have to use her.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Matt and Ben, where they played Matt Affleck and Ben, Ben Damon. I love that. Matt Affleck and Ben Damon. And they did a show. And now is there anyone, you know, who would not put Mindy Kaling in something?
Yeah.
But she created the opportunity for herself by showing that she had something. That's where that's where you become undeniable.
Yeah.
Because now you make it easy for them, those people that don't want to lose their jobs and are afraid and don't know what to do. Because we always do have this. We always do have our creativity. We always do have our talent. We always have, you know, I'm undeniable now because I have just sheer balls, sheer grit, sheer, you know.
And that goes so far in LA, because I mean, it, you have to. If you don't, you're not going to stand out. You're not going to go the extra mile. You're not going to put yourself, yeah, in an uncomfortable position to meet someone or to go to, you know, a casting audition or whatever. I mean, it's, you have to have confidence, even if, yeah, you're faking it. You have to go in there,
yeah,
believing in yourself.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with faking it, because, you know, I used to think negatively about faking it, but I didn't fake it for so long. But here's the thing about faking it. I don't even think it's faking it. It's neuroplasticity. It's our brain needs to figure out what we need to do to make this happen. And so it's like cutting a ditch in the dirt. The first pass is not going to create much. Mm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You, like if you're dragging a big farm, machinery, and you want to cut a 6-foot trench, the first pass is only going to remove a few inches. You're not faking it. You're getting started.
Yep.
You're teaching your brain how to do what it needs to do the way you need to do it. So there's a truthfulness and an authenticity even to, hey, you know what? I'm going to make a first pass at this. I'm going to do this is the best I can. You know, and that is to us, you know, we'll refer to that as faking it till you make it. But I would even give yourself more credit than that. No, you're taking a first pass at digging a 6-foot trench. And so the first pass may not look like much is happening.
Yeah. No, but I like that.
You're recreating the wiring in your brain to say, okay, that which I couldn't do before, now I'm going to be able to do it.
Well, and on some levels, even to be able to go fake it, you still have to believe in yourself, as you know what I mean, at a certain point. Yeah. And then it just grows.
Yeah.
That belief grows.
Yeah, you have to have hope. Hope is important. There has to be some reason. Hope is the belief that something you do will have an impact that you can't see right now.
Yeah.
That you'll feel later.
Absolutely. Share with our listeners just a little bit about what The Sublime and Beautiful is. And I have some questions about that.
Okay.
The movie. Yeah.
It's been a while. So I made Sublime and Beautiful in 2012. I made it in 2 weeks for $30,000, all crowdfunded.
Oh my God.
Remember, I went to school for business marketing. So I decided that I would make a movie in spite of all the obstacles, and that I would create a path to this movie based on what I had to do. Is I had to divorce myself from any preconceived notion that there was only this way to make a movie. Mm-hmm. I had to embrace, no, there's infinite ways to make a movie. And once I make the movie, I've made the movie. I have to turn every obstacle into an opportunity and figure out how to do it. So that's what I did. I built a bridge to my future. The story itself is about a Midwestern family. And because I had so little money and resources, I placed my acting talent at center of it, that I was going to be in every scene. And that's because I knew I could shoot 8-9 pages a day and shoot it in 12 days. If I was in every scene carrying the entire movie, I didn't know if I could do that to another actor, but I knew that I could do it, that I could shoot, you know. So the opportunity became to make it sort of this meditation on this guy's experience of grief. He has a horrible tragedy. And creatively, I was pulling things from real life and things that were inspirational. My aunt got hit by a drunk driver when I was in college. So that, you know, stayed with me. I lost my best friend to cancer when he was in his mid-20s. And I had feelings of grief that I never saw portrayed on screen, mostly because anytime people made a movie about grief, they have to chase awards. So when you have to chase awards to reverse engineer a movie about grief, you kind of have to give the actor all of this, all these places to go for performance. And my experience of grief is that at least in the initial stages, the first few months, maybe even year, you're stuck. And movies about people who are stuck don't get made. I mean, it's literally the first rule of screenwriting, that there's a character arc. Well, my experience of grief is that there's no arc. There is literally stuck. And so I said, I'm going to make this niche movie that tells the truth to people. And if you've experienced profound grief, I hope and pray that you'll recognize that I understand, that I felt it. So I made a movie about that because I had no money and no resources. So I didn't have to chase any awards or any attention. I could just make the movie I wanted to make the way I experienced grief. And fortunately for me,
it did get awards.
Because there was an authenticity. It comes back to authenticity. There was an authenticity to it. And so literally people loved it or hated it, but they felt the truth of it to the degree that I could share it. And that truth just became undeniable to certain people and changed my life. Like there are people that I'm still in contact today that saw this movie along the way and it profoundly impacted their life. And God, as an artist, I mean, that's everything. As an artist, touch people the way my movie touched people. Life changing.
See, what I've watched it a couple times and it's a hard watch. I mean, like you said, the father loses his three kids to a drunk driver. But the way, like when you said meditation, that is exactly what it is. And until you said that, I didn't realize it, but it is very beautiful in that it is authentic. And I think a lot of actors would overact in your situation, but you handled it perfectly. Like you said, you were stuck. You just kind of were just on autopilot, right? And
searching for a few things here and there, and getting derailed by a few things, and there is a little bit of dramatic tension. I did want to be mindful that it was not a documentary, and that there is a little bit of, you know, but even visually, I tried to shoot the movie, if you've noticed, to create a little bit of a leaning forward to pull you from one moment to the next. Just visually, the approach was, a lot of the scenes start with a shot that doesn't allow you to know exactly where you are. Like there's no big establishing shots.
I was going to talk about that, like maybe through a little small window or something.
Yeah, you would start so small so it created a little bit of a mystery in each scene as to where I was finding myself next. And then as the scene would open up, you'd go, oh, we're at the hospital now. Oh, just small little things like this. This was to help my audience because I knew I was telling a movie about a person who was stuck. So it needed to have some forward lean. So visually I tried to, you know, make a little bit of a mystery, like where are we finding Dave now? Oh, he's in his garage. Oh, he's loading a shotgun. Oh shit. Oh, something is going on here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was kind of it. So if you think about it, a lot of huge things are really happening today.
Yes.
How many people put a shotgun under their chin?
Right.
But when you're watching the movie, it does feel like nothing's happening.
It's so fascinating because you're right. Just all these little tiny things that kind of keep it moving forward. And I have to say, I think one of my favorite scenes was when they were at the holiday party and all of a sudden your wife snapped. But it was so perfect because it had been building up, you know, for both of you in different ways. And when people are around people who've suffered grief, it makes them uncomfortable and they don't know always how to act. And so a lot of people that you might not even know are going to give you a big hug and try to kind of maybe like know you like they don't really, you know, more than they do. And she reacted to that.
Most people handle your grief as their grief.
Yes. Exactly.
And it's not. Their kids did not die. And it's hard to, these are all real life experiences. All of these things. I mean, there wasn't a holiday party, but that moment happened both to Laura and to me when we dealt with our grief. These were all drawn. So yeah, for me as the storyteller, the audience needed that release and they weren't getting it with the character of David. And listen, in most Hollywood writing formulaic situations, they would come to me and say, well, you can't have the cathartic event happen to the character we're not following for the whole movie. Mm. And I'd be like, I think it's interesting. I'm going to try it. because I had no one giving me $2 million, even $2 million, you know, whether it be eight.
Chirping in your ear. Right.
And saying, you can't do it this way because I did do something you don't do. I mean, if you think about it, here's this movie where the cathartic, real catharsis happens for a character you're not really with most of the movie. You're with the other guy who doesn't have it, who isn't cracking. But that makes her. And that's also because most marriages don't survive the death of a child. And the reason they don't is because people grieve differently. Mm. And when people grieve differently, they can't, it becomes very difficult to maintain a relationship. And there's just too much water to carry.
Yeah.
So I felt like I had to show that these two people are grieving differently. And part of the reason she's grieving differently is because Dave's not available to her.
Yeah.
You know, they're not connecting on any level. So this holiday party becomes unbearable for her in a different way.
Yeah.
And yes, it was done in a way that you can't really do it in a movie, because I did. I broke like seven rules of filmmaking.
Well, and, I mean, it was perfect.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And people either love it or hate it. And I'm good with that. I didn't want people to be on the fence. Yeah. I didn't want people to be like, it's all right. As an artist, I wanted people to have a strong reaction to it and feel strongly about something.
Sure. As I'm watching and I'm kind of wondering, like, how is this going to end? And all of a sudden, I think what you did was just perfect. I mean, it was so understated, but yet there's a glimmer of hope there, how he's connecting with the family of the person who caused the wreck.
Yeah, because they're all survivors of grief at this point.
Yep.
And so, yeah, and I did try to villainize the murderer in David's eyes, but not in the audience's eyes. Again, which is difficult to do. You're kind of skirting some screenwriting laws there. Like, I wanted only David to think of him as the villain. The audience, I wanted to be a little more open to, because you know what? Anyone can make that mistake. Anyone can drink too much. I've drunk too much and driven, even after having the tragedy in my life. Now, it was when I was younger. It hasn't happened in years. And now it's no reason for it to happen because everyone has an app on their phone and could do it. But human beings do horrible things and they're responsible and they make huge mistakes. And I, as a storyteller, am not interested in villainizing him, but I am interested in what happens when one person does villainize another person. And Dave is holding him responsible.
Yeah.
But remember, Dave wasn't where he was supposed to be that night either. So it's complicated for Dave to hold him responsible. He has
it is.
His whole journey is very complicated because he needs to villainize this guy because of his own guilt.
Yep.
Like he's trying to survive as a human being by making it this guy. And you know, and it is. Mm. It is his fault. But as an artist, you'll notice in all of my movies, I'm more interested in the questions than the answers. The questions, I think, are what connect us as human beings. I'm not as interested in movies that say, here's the answer, here's the answer, here's the answer. That kind of makes me think, fuck
different. You did an amazing job. I mean, I cannot believe you only made it for $30,000 too. That's just, you should be very proud of yourself.
Thank you.
For those people out there that don't necessarily know the process, we're having a wrap up here in a little bit, but
okay. Yeah.
Go through the directing process from pre-production through the editing process. Oh, I mean, as a director, not a producer. Well, I mean, just
in the next 2 minutes.
Well, maybe we should have you on again sometime. I mean, I've got so many questions I want to ask you, but you know, as a director, not as a producer, but just like a director, are you laying out the shots? Like, let me ask you this way: since you also acted in it, you obviously probably had an idea of how you wanted to, carry your character through the film. Did it change a little bit sometimes when you showed up one day and you had a certain scene? Did you kind of say, you know what, maybe I'll do it like this?
Yeah. Okay, so you asked me that. So I'm going to just, instead of being macro, I'm going to be micro.
Okay.
My feeling as a director is the moment is everything.
Yeah.
And you've got to, it's great to have your vision. It's great to have your ideas. It's great to have everything. But do not slam a square peg into a round hole. Mm. I see this happen on films all the time, whether it be time, resources, light, energy, an actor. All I can say as a director is be available to the moment. Your idea can pass through that moment and still retain the essence of everything you wanted to say. And in fact, most of the time can be amplified if you take advantage of what's happening. For real, with the light, with the location, with the human being. I see so many directors, and here's the beauty of being an actor who observed.
Yeah.
I am avoiding mistakes that I've seen other people's make. And, and most directors aren't on hundreds of sets. They're on their sets, and maybe a few others if they went to directing school. Mm. But even those are kind of modeled because of the school and the nature of the educational process. They're all very similar that, you know, I've been on so many and they're so different. So I steal from everyone. And most of what I steal is what not to do.
Yeah.
And what I see most people try to do is in their fear, in their panic. I'm telling you, it doesn't matter how little time or how little resources. Mostly what you need to do is take a deep breath, calm down, and look for the opportunity. The gift is right there. The best shots in my movie occurred because I took a breath and looked at what was available. The shot where we're tracking the drunk driver and we pick him up through the windows and everything. That was only because, you know, we knew we were landing at that sandwich shop. And so we looked around outside the sandwich shop. And I knew that, you know, in the bigger idea that I wanted to feel this feeling of David following this guy and he doesn't know it. You find that shot. And then we get the reflection of the car just happened to pass, right? And it was beautiful. Mm. And then when you get into the editing room, you throw away as much of preconceived notion about what the movie is and refine it. Make it prove itself to you again. Again, here's my golden rule. Do not jam a square peg into a round hole. Take a deep breath. Mm-hmm. And look and find out what the solution is. People worry about time and money and then their own fears that they're making mistakes. Gotta let go of all of that. Just kind of look for the beauty of the moment. Be present. Stay in the moment and direct from there.
Well, I love that. I mean, I can't tell you how many things I've done, whether it was a book or another project of my own, that changed as I was going through it. It things evolve, and you just have to be okay with that. And it's going to be better.
Yeah. It's always amplifying something that at its core is the story. Mm-hmm. Like, look, my movie is my movie. It's a better version of it than even what I started with, because I allowed the moment to inform it.
Mm-hmm. That's where the magic happens. You got to be flexible.
You're searching for magic. So just create a situation where magic can take place and then be open to it when it's there. And it may not be exactly how you, but if you, like, I knew that I was making a movie that was basically, if you've experienced grief, Dave's journey will look authentic to you. Boom, movie.
Yeah.
Now everything can fit into that container. So I mean, every little magical thing goes into that vase.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry, like, I just, you know, so it is a combination of having a vision, the overall.
Of course. You got to start with that.
Yeah. And no, does this fit in my vase? Does this fit into my into my container? Does this go in? And as a director, I think your job on every level, the responsibility is yours to be the filter for the audience. Mm-hmm. That's your job, ultimately. Like everything, you are the filter through which everything creative and artistic passes through, and you've got to trust that filter. But a director who doesn't take that on as their responsibility gets left letting a lot of other people make decisions. Now, I'm not saying don't collaborate. Mm-hmm. I surrounded myself with a lot of talent, and all of that talent had contributed, and it was very collaborative. But I've got to be a benevolent dictator, and I've got to own the role. I've got to step up and say, I'm the tastemaker. I'm the filter. I am the king. So ultimately, I have to say yes. This passes through my filter.
Amen. I mean, ultimately, it's you share an experience, and as an audience member, we're always reading or watching or something. We're putting ourselves in that place. Like, how would we handle that? Right? We're running it through our own filters. So,
I hope
you, absolutely. And so you did a great job of just sharing that experience to kind of let other people just kind of like maybe set themselves in there and experience it for themselves.
Right.
Yeah. Couple quick questions.
Yeah.
Your new screenplay, In the Lake of Fire, it's doing well. Are you wanting, in the competitions, are you wanting to do the same thing as you did with The Sublime and Beautiful? Make that yourself?
Yeah, I'm going to direct it. That's the plan. I kind of wrote it because Hollywood story, I had another script that I had found that I didn't write, that I had developed, that I was hoping to direct, and it got removed. It got taken from me very swiftly, very Hollywood-y, very, thank you, sir, may I have another? Ouch. And then one of my idols in the industry and I were having a conversation, and through that conversation was, yeah, you've got to write what you're still in a place in your career where you're not in a position to stop that from happening to you, except one way, if you own the content. So I was like, in my mind, I was like, I've got to become a better fucking writer, and I've got to write more content for myself to direct, because content that I don't have control over can be taken from me swiftly and painfully.
Yeah.
And so I wrote In the Lake of Fire, and I will just share this: grit, perseverance, whatever. I've been writing since I wrote The Sublime and Beautiful, which we shot in 2012, but I started writing in 2004 or 5. I can't even remember. Mm-hmm. And then after I wrote that, I tried to see if I could write something else, and I took on these other things. I've got 20 scripts out there that I've written, but I would say in the last 2.5 years, I've written 3 that we can make that I think are on the verge of being something. I got good because I kept doing it. I, and I wrote In the Lake of Fire. I started writing it literally the day they put us in quarantine in California.
That
they
said, okay.
We're going to shelter in place.
Yeah.
And I went to my computer and I'd had these ideas banging around in my head. And I took a couple of them together and smashed them into a script. And I wrote it. And I remember, and I have a few rules as a writer that I'll share that I didn't always have. One is you write the first draft as fast as humanly fucking possible because because momentum is everything and you just need a beginning, middle, and end. And truthfully, it's going to change. The whole thing is rewriting anyway. So just don't be precious with the first draft. Just get it. Just so I slammed it out literally in a couple of weeks. And then I started, now this I probably wouldn't do again, but then I started sharing it with like the Blacklist website and everything because I wanted feedback right away. Well, it really wasn't ready, but something about it was special and it caught people's attention right away. I mean, it literally had no third act. I tried to create an ending, you know, because I knew, but it, no. And it took development. It took people saying some really hard things about it, but along the way, it did keep getting, like, I could tell I was onto something. And I also, when I finished writing, I was like, oh, I'm a much better writer now than I was when I didn't have any confidence in this. And all these failed, and I won't say failed because they're not really failed, but all these movies that are now just living in a file or in a drawer, or on cyberspace, but they've taken me where I want to go. I'm a really good writer now. And so, you know what? With that comes a little more leverage. So I did. I submitted. I would say it's one of the most awarded scripts of the year last year. Mm. On Coverfly, it's in the top 100 out of like 65,000 scripts since Coverfly's inception. I mean, I won 7 major prizes at major awards places. Jeez. That,
yeah.
And I would have never done that with Sublime. Sublime would have gotten chewed up and spit out. I had to put on the page, make it good enough to get actors and people to do it with me. Mm-hmm. But it would never stood the gauntlet of the screenwriting world where, you know,
sure,
where you're anonymous, they're anonymous, and people say what they want to say. But you also have to hold on to your vision because they're just people with ideas too.
Yeah.
And I say that, you know what? Everyone's got an asshole and they all stink. Everyone's got an opinion and they all stink.
Well,
it's what you want to make of it. You have to have some, like, I at my core knew what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it. So I was able to sift through. Like, if I didn't have some chops and some belief and some internal thing, I could have just let that whole thing grind me up and spit me out. Because that script, which has won all those awards, did recently, because I got 8s on the Blacklist, I'll get free reviews. And I did get a 4 recently on that script. And they hated the movie.
They just could have been jealous. Like,
but they have no idea. They have no idea that it literally just placed as a semifinalist in the Nickel Award. And I guess, and I'll tell you what, if they did, they would have changed their entire thing. Because that's how fucked up the business is.
Do you hope that it's picked up, or do you want to do it yourself? You know what I mean? I know you want to direct it, but I mean, like,
well,
you know,
without getting into too much of the mechanics of it.
Yeah.
Now I have movies. I have movies to share. So when I say I want to direct it, people can look at my movies and go, okay.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened, because it did win all these awards and through social media, is I've had people reaching out to me asking to read it. I would say we're at 6 or 7 of those opportunities. Some of them are like small film companies, you know, starting out film companies. Some, but there are 2 in the last week that are like, mini majors that are places where awards films get made and win awards.
Nice.
I don't know who's going to make it or how. All I know is it's going to happen. I don't know how.
Sure. It's not quite time yet.
It will. It's the you know, Who Ate My Cheese? Is that
Who Moved My Cheese? Yeah, that old self-help book.
Yeah, which is very true. You know that there's some cheese somewhere and you're going to eat it, but there's a maze to get there. And I don't know what the maze is exactly, but I've been here. I trust it. I know myself in the process. I know the script's good enough. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I can't name any names, but two companies that have produced and could finance this movie in a heartbeat have asked to look at it. And one of those conversations was a development exec saying, what's out there that could win awards? And someone who knew of the script said, this script could win awards. And wow. She said, tell me the log line. And he did. And she said, I want to read it. And so they contacted me and my producer and said, I want to read that script. And that company has won many Academy Awards. So we'll see. Mm. Doesn't mean we're going to make it.
No, I know, but yeah.
An energy or a synergy to that. But everyone that we're giving the script to gets this. Blake's going to direct it. So if that's a no-go, don't read it or read it and just know that that's the way we start the next conversation.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Oh, yeah. I wish you all the best with that. My gosh.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Last question. You're doing it all. Do you have a preference, writing, directing, acting, or you still want to do a little bit of everything?
I love it all.
Good.
For different reasons.
Yep.
Yeah. No, I don't have a preference. I have landed on that branding of I'm a storyteller, so I can do that in a variety of ways. And some of it is just telling the story of a character within someone else's part, like, you know, being an actor. Mm-hmm. Like if someone says, oh, I want you to act in this. I just went and did a table read of a movie yesterday, got to act. And it had been a little while since I had acted, and I had so much fun. I mean, it's fun to act and to not worry about, you know,
all the behind the scenes stuff.
they asked me about some of the bigger things because they know they probably had a conversation with me they wouldn't have had 10 years ago. Hmm. Because knowing that I have made films and this and that and written films and stuff. So, but I also have to be very careful to know my role because no one wants an actor telling you, you know, I do remember after I directed Sublime and Beautiful, I went to
start giving unsolicited advice.
Exactly. I went and shot a movie and I was watching and I was the actor and I had a small part in this movie, but I'm watching it. I'm like, oh, they really need to reframe this because they're not going to be able to edit this shot. like I could see them painting themselves into a corner I have, which you're either going to go left or right. You're going to have to make a choice in editing where you either get all of this idea or all of this idea. And I was like, one little shot and you would have your option of all of it. Does that make sense? Like
yeah,
I could see
that
happening because of the filmmaker. And no, I bit my tongue.
It was not my place. No, you say something to the PA and say, pass it on.
No.
I'm joking.
Exactly. But if I'm on a set where someone knows and responds and likes, you know, I'll get a wink. I'll get a nudge. Are we good? And I'll be like, yeah, I think so. Or someone will say, Blake, you know, sometimes now, I mean, I've also acted and executive produced on a movie. And part of the reason I did is because those people wanted my opinion on certain things. I saved them a lot of money on that movie.
Yeah.
Because I have experience as a filmmaker and know some things about saving money in production, post-production.
No, that's huge.
Elevate something. So you got to read the room, though. Got to read the room.
Yes, you do. Just like anything.
And it is nice just to be there and only have the responsibility of acting. I can live with that. I'm good with that. I love it.
Oh boy. I've had a blast chatting with you. Blake, thank you for sharing insights into a little bit of you know, the directing aspects of it, the acting and the writing.
It's been my pleasure. I've enjoyed it. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Thank you for listening to The Creative Spark. To learn more about host G. Brian Benson, his latest best-selling book, Habits for Success, and this week's amazing guest, please visit the show notes. And we love building community, making new friends, and spreading the goodness, so don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, as Brian always says, be well, be creative, and always be yourself.